My name is Elizabeth Murphy, and I'm 65. Today is October 3rd, 2007. We're on the 8th floor of the Marriott Waterfront Hotel in Baltimore, Maryland, and my partner is a good friend of mine.
And I'm Renata Rusky Shelton. I'm 56 years, and I go with Betty's date. We're in the same room, so I assume it's the same date. I guess you're my friend, colleague, and confidant at times.
All right.
We've known each other quite a while, I think.
That's true. Well, I'll sign up for that, too.
So, Betty, I guess I'd like to ask you, in terms of your professional life, you told me a little bit that you actually would have liked to have a different career when you started. Do you regret having a career in human factors?
Oh, absolutely not. No, it's really worked out well for me, and I've really enjoyed it, and all the aspects of human factors are very compatible with my interests and concerns and that sort of thing.
Do you think you might switch at some point and go back to that first career? You've been known to do some sort of educational jumping around occasionally.
Oh, have I been? Well, my first career was in teaching. I taught English in high school, and I don't think at this point that I would go back to teaching. Although I am interested, though, in literacy, and I think in retirement I would probably get involved in some literacy activities, maybe in the D.C. area.
Oh, interesting.
And that's related, of course, to English and reading and, you know, helping kids and adults who have trouble reading.
And I understand you now have grandchildren. And as a sort of a message to your grandchildren sometime in the future, what would you like to share about your work life in human factors or teaching or other activities that you've been involved with?
Well, that's a big question, Renata. I have one grandchild at the moment. He's 13, and we have two on the way. Mm-hmm. So, I think they will both be considered in different generations. The ones coming along will be some unknown name generation. But as far as what I'd like to tell them, about my career. Well, so many things come to mind, but I think one thing is to do something that you really enjoy. Don't just do it because somebody tells you this is what they want you to do, you know, and follow some inspiration that's going to keep you going during the times when things get tedious.
What was your inspiration for the human factors? Or even now, what is your inspiration for keeping going in human factors?
Well, I think it's mainly the idea of how much human factors can do for people and for the world. I think I said to you yesterday, human factors could save the world if they would let us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that can be done to improve people's lives in small ways and large ways through human factors and usability.
What do you think human factors will be like if it will be still a profession when your grandkids might be in their 30s?
So I think it'll still be a profession because there's such a need, tremendous need. Will it be like?
Can you describe the need? Like what is needed?
Well, the whole idea behind human factors, as you know so well, mm-hmm. is making designs and products compatible with people, the way people think. I particularly think about computer user interfaces and how difficult they can be and how much better they can be if you put some thought into the thought process, the user's thought process and the logic. Mm-hmm. Now I need to ask you some questions, Renata.
Feel free. I'm ready.
Let me turn that back on you and ask you what you think human factors will be like in 30 years.
Well, I think we had the theme in our opening plenary session at the Human Factors Association for 2007, which started talking about dreams rather than what we think the future might be like, just because we know that life will change, and that's kind of the only thing we're certain about is change. Mm-hmm. And so in conversations with you this morning at breakfast, too, we talked about the changing technologies, the experiences from our lifetime, from anywhere, no television, to the most sophisticated wiki spaces, collaborative tools, the access to information, mm-hmm. how different it was in the past for us to even access information. I remember running computer programs, having to walk a mile and a half across campus with a mm-hmm. stack of cards.
Me too.
To run the program. So projecting that out into the future is quite a feat. I think there are some predictions being made which are somewhat worrisome to me, that people will spend a lot of time playing with their bodies and physiology, and that must affect their minds as well. There's things like nutraceuticals. Yesterday, they're of course pharmaceuticals, but there's testing of genetic makeup and then doing augmentation for either cognition or physical augmentation, getting mm-hmm. into robotics, the robotic woman that they have on TV right now. I think that's certainly a movement to be seen. I think the world will be a different place in terms of security issues, personal space, mm-hmm. personal preservation. Everything is digital, and sometimes I wonder what will be there left to do for us when, you know, everything is stored and everything is sort of predicted and figured out and tested and analyzed, and, you know, we presumably, if we sort of write the story to the end, won't have anything to do.
Well,
what do you think?
Okay. Well, I think as long as there's a human in there, there'll be a place for human factors.
So there's human nature will ward off against these sort of forces. What about information and the amounts of information that even young kids are forced to deal with, and, you know, from television, mm-hmm. visual messaging, and then how to interpret and how to make decisions based on all
right.
that input. How much information do we really need?
Well, probably a lot less than we're getting. There's a tremendous overload. I've seen statistics on it. It's a huge amount of information, far more than the human brain can deal with. I mean, we know that. So information management is a big issue.
So maybe one of the new technologies will be the information sampler. Mm-hmm. It'll be a little pocket handheld device, and it's the I sample or the mm-hmm. I know that you mm-hmm. carry in your pocket as a device. And for any question that may arise, and you could probably, it might be like a credit card slot, you could put it in your transportation unit and mm-hmm. it'll take you to the destination that you should be going to. It can order your groceries or your meals and your food and set up the appliances. So these are some of the mm-hmm. technologies which may be imminent, potentially.
Right, but the human still has to, or the user still has to say what they want to sample or what they want for dinner, and it has to be relatively easy to use. We do have some of those things now. I mean, a smart house and different.
So I guess I was just thinking that maybe we'll just have more of that to sort mm-hmm. of the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, up until recently, I really did think that, you know, there's something very nice about the human because we don't change that much.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we are evolving, and there's new adaptations that we as a human race are undertaking right now. And mm-hmm. I think we're at a point, at least it seems to me, where there is a revolution, another notch up in that mm-hmm. sort of evolution, where demands will be made on the human being in this, where we have to coordinate and collaborate with each other than be these single entities.
Right.
I see that as a big mm-hmm. shift. Do you see that too?
Well, the mm-hmm. multitasking, if that's part of it, I think will just grow enormously. I just, as a little anecdote, I saw someone the other day in the hotel walking down a hallway, and he was on the phone, on the cell phone with someone. He recognized a colleague who was coming toward him, shook the man's hand, spoke to him, still on the phone. The man had his wife with him, introduced heard to the man on the phone. The man on the phone said, "Nice to meet you, Cindy," was still on the phone, and they said goodbye and parted, and he was still on the phone. And mm-hmm. I've never witnessed anything like that before. It was amazing.
It's almost a virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, this ability to have presence in remote places is another big technology mm-hmm. driver.
Mm-hmm.
Both right now we're starting to see some of that. And it will change the skills that we need to have.
Oh, the skills will change.
To cope with all of
this.
But
the human capabilities,
right,
though,
won't,
probably
yes.
won't change. So that's
well,
what we're up against.
We can
know.
Augment ourselves with mm-hmm. the technology.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
But still, there needs to be a decision point. This is actually... You'd ask me, or maybe I can ask that question to you, why we are interested in certain areas in human factors. My area of interest has always been around decision-making,
mm-hmm.
because at some point you need to make a decision
right.
or something to take some action. How about yourself?
Well, I'm very interested in decision-making. That's my topic of my dissertation was decision-making. And I do see it as a critical area. And we have all these different biases in decision-making that a lot of people are not aware of. And those can be manipulated also, the whole area of advertising and, you know, Madison Avenue,
messaging
and manipulating people's decision making. So where does free will come in, you know, to how much of that really is your own decision, and to what extent has it been guided
mm-hmm.
by some outside agency? And there's some concern or worry there about, you know, the Big Brother mentality taking over.
This conversation actually reminds me a lot about the many meetings we have over dinner.
Yes.
We eventually end up all about philosophy, and that's what I always mm-hmm. like about you, Betty, is that we can talk philosophy. And, you know, from a waiter's perspective, we at the same time complain about the service or the inefficiencies of whatever environment we are in. We pick that up as well, but... we have sort of these different levels of discussion, but we always end up at this very wisdom stage. And we've been there, I think, from our younger days to up until now. We were wise beyond our years early on. Don't you think?
I think so. Yeah. Earlier you asked me about inspiration, and I would say that you're one of the most inspiring people I've encountered in my professional career.
Well, thank you, Patty.
Because tremendous ability and always thinking ahead and making predictions. And although you say it's not possible to make predictions, you're very forward thinking, and you always can see a way to solve whatever an issue is.
But you keep me very well grounded, Betty, because you have all these wonderful skills, and you demand explanations from me, so that pulls me back. And I think our collaboration, I managed to co-publish a paper or book chapter with you once, and that was very much born out of a conversation that we had, and then we just sat down a couple of weekends on your back deck.
Right, with some German wine.
With some German wine. And we hacked out this book chapter, which was in air traffic control, cognitive factors.
Information processing. Right.
And
well, we make a good team, I think.
Right.
You have the genius.
Not so.
And I will plot along and make sure the sentences are grammatical and punctuation is in the right place and that sort of thing.
I guess I really would like to ask you one more question in terms of your career. Can you think of any outrageous moments in your career, something that you really, you know, either got totally upset about or was totally enjoyed? Or
well, I can think of one that comes to mind immediately when you say outrageous. I was working on, I think it was a proposal, when I was a contractor for a company which shall remain nameless. And I was using a somewhat academic method in that I was citing references for various things, and I thought that that would be somewhat impressive to the reader, and that it was important for the company to back up what they were saying, not just make all these claims, but to back them up. Well, the person who was heading the team said, "Oh no, those all have to go. You know, we can't have any. You know, it has to be our work. It can't. We can't be putting someone else's work forward in a proposal." Well, that meant that if they took out all the references, that we were stealing other people's work. I was very upset. In fact, I walked out. I almost quit the company. I was so upset. It's a long story, but they decided to keep them in. I was going to leave. Yeah. I mean, I just couldn't take it. It was so outrageous.
Well, that sounds like an intellectual property rights. This is another big topic that comes around, particularly when you talk about collaboration and interdisciplinary collaboration, and everybody in the technology enabling even countries and scientists from different countries to talk to each other. But that is very much still an unknown and a legal concern. And the current commercial world is certainly not set up to share information freely, when in fact we've sort of learned that's necessary to make some progress at times. There's I think throughout both of our careers, we've clashed with these systems that don't seem to fit somewhere.
Right. How about you? Can you think of an outrageous event?
Yes. My early years, I actually worked at NASA Ames Research Center, and this was a very male-dominated environment. And we had some visiting scientists, and there was a dinner plan for the group. I was part of the human factors group. And one of the older males with a medical degree actually asked me, "What are you doing here? Why aren't you home cooking dinner for your husband?" And I was so perplexed, I couldn't say anything at the time. And then I thought, did I understand that right? And I thought he was joking, but only to find out that he wasn't. And for me, it was like one big joke, and I just kind of walked around perplexed for a lot of time. And there's been incidences, and I think we shared, and we kind of shared yesterday in terms of what it meant for us as females to be in this still very male-dominated world, because human factors came out of a military tradition. And at presentations, the magic word little was always used when a woman was introduced to give her presentation. So-and-so will now give her little presentation was always what was said. They always managed somehow to put these diminutive adjectives in there. And you could kind of see around the room, you know, women, what the few of us that were there, we just like. But there was really very little we could do.
I think that's changed a lot.
It's changed a lot, I think, with a lot of work. But it wasn't that long ago when it happened. So, you know,
and
maybe
I suppose
10, 15 years.
There's still a lot of that sort of undercurrent, but it's not so overt as it used to be.
I still hear it. At least people, some of our male colleagues still admit when a thought comes to mind and they stop themselves and say, "I better not say this because I just had diversity training," or something like that. They won't say it anymore. But
they
still
might
think
it. But not say it.
But it's very nice at this conference. We're almost there at a 50-50 percent, and there's been certainly a lot more women recognized even by the society now.
Yes.
And they've always been around, but they were not that obvious. And it's kind of nice now that somebody will ask, you know, there's the wrong picture here. With we're not just all males. And in medicine, at least, we know that gender makes tremendous differences now. The data that was collected. You know, we have now women in aircraft, and even the ergonomics and the figures being used, you know, you used to have the bolster seats and the things, just because everything was designed for men. So,
yeah, I enjoy seeing the diversity, not only in the gender area, but in other areas too, seeing people coming in with other backgrounds, other ethnic and racial backgrounds into the society, because people come in all colors and sizes and shapes
and accents
from all different countries. You know, we we actually have quite an outreach into other parts of the world, which I like to see. And the young people coming in, I try to, as much as I can, try to encourage them and pass the torch to them, that sort of thing.
Do you remember any particular person in your life, in your career, a professional person that inspired you, or that you, like a professional woman, or was there a model that you and would like to have emulated, that you do emulate?
Well, I've spoken about you, Renata.
We'll
assume you. But in addition, I think of Sylvia Shepherd, who was one of the originators of human-computer interaction, software psychology. Mm-hmm. She was my manager at one point, and I learned a tremendous amount from her. Very professional role model, very assertive, never would shrink back because of a male comment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Christine Mitchell from Georgia Tech, mm-hmm. who was my advisor when she was at George Mason. Again, extremely professional. Both of those people are extremely bright and just could outshine just about any man in the room, if mm-hmm. not all of them, mm-hmm. And knew how to handle situations. So I learned a lot from just being around them and watching them. And mm-hmm. I have to mention Lisa Stewart, who was a peer. We were students together at George Mason, and I worked with her for quite a while. She is so good on closing the communication loop with people on a team, making sure everybody knows the same information. You Wonderful. Know, if there's something new, that everybody gets to hear it, mm-hmm. Because that those loops can be broken right. so easily, and then people think, oh, well, why didn't I know this? Or they don't know about a meeting, or there's bad feeling, or whatever. I could also mm-hmm. mention people who are the opposite of those, mm-hmm. who were one woman in particular, I won't mention the name, but just always focused on the work, didn't care about the people, or gave the impression of not caring, mm-hmm. and the whole team was demoralized. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot about, you know,
failures,
showing a human concern for the people you work with. That would be a message to the grandchildren. You know, you don't just leave your emotions in the parking lot, and your team members don't either, and they're people, and you need to get to know them and care for them and nurture them, and they'll be loyal forever. I'm so loyal to the people I mentioned.
That's actually a wonderful mm-hmm. message, wonderful insight. It's kind mm-hmm. of sort of a modern phrase of this. It's the human,
right? Exactly. yes,
and human factors. Mm-hmm. It's like we've, and at times I noticed that people lose track of the fact that what it means actually mm-hmm. to human factors. It's not these physiological measures mm-hmm. and the science that's around it. It's we are very complex human beings with emotions and thoughts and mm-hmm. feelings, and that mm-hmm. is the context. And you don't really have an opportunity to make up for some of this. We need that whole feeling of belonging in a professional context as well. Mm-hmm. And for communication, it's absolutely mm-hmm. vital. I totally
right.
agree.
Right. Mm-hmm. How about people who inspired you, Renata?
Well, you know, I think it's been books and ideas more so than people. Occasionally, I would find somebody who would be absolutely excellent at doing something, and I'd listen in and I'd learn. But for a long time, I was looking for mentors, and you know, I had sort of this idea that there's these big people with all their skills, and I guess along the way, I sort of found out that they're not that big, and mm-hmm. and particularly if they didn't show those similar skills in terms of caring about their fellow professionals, that they stopped being so impressive.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that I always think that it really is important, not just the academic knowledge you have and the professional knowledge, that you are a principled human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I've mm-hmm. I've guess I either didn't pay too much attention or I had some counter evidence for that from some of the people I worked with. So I just kind of plugged along, with the exception, of course, of you, Betty.
Oh, wow.
And so it's been a true delight to have people like you and finally meet somebody that he can talk about all kinds mm-hmm. of topics, mm-hmm. both as a friend, personal level, and with family issues, and in the professional conversation. So it's very rare, and I really thank you.
Oh, it's a great gift of friendship and I'm not sure what to call it, but just a fellow feeling, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What are your plans for retirement, Betty? In terms of not when or whatever, but what do you see yourself doing?
Well, you asked me the other day whether I would write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one possibility. I probably wouldn't do it by myself. I might want to write something on human factors and usability that would be an edited book and mm-hmm. maybe have people like you and Terry O'Connell and different people contribute chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So get ready. I'm going to ask you.
Only with your wonderful editing pen. But yes, I think I feel now at a time in my life where I finally do have things to say that might mm-hmm. be of interest to other people. And I think I'm actually finally interested much more in other people themselves
mm-hmm.
and their life paths. And because we do have only a short time left to go, it seems that maybe that is kind of what one does at mm-hmm. this stage in life, and to try to teach or write or give lessons learned mm-hmm. and just share. And there might mm-hmm. be a tremendous interest amongst the younger people to know more about that.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, I guess that's largely what this whole program is about. StoryCorps.
Mm-hmm. Renata, you mentioned products that have been specifically designed for certain people that then had to be changed. You mentioned seats on airplanes for pilots that were designed for men.
Right.
Can you think of other products that have recently had to be changed, maybe so that they would suit a different kind of person better?
Right. Actually, what comes to mind is just even new products that have been designed to help people work, and women specifically. I was in a presentation yesterday where actually a lady got the design award for a chair that was developed for a back weaving. It's a back weaving stool. And this is for women in Guatemala. There are 50,000 of them who are suffering ergonomic knee joint problems and can work no longer as weavers. And this is what their livelihood depends on. And so they were kneeling on the floor doing this. And so this was a nonprofit organization. The name escapes me at the moment. But there's a wonderful effort where an ergonomist pro bono actually did some work. There are usually it's products where size differences are, but there's also in the commercial world primarily colors are typically added because women like to be color coordinated, and so this black cell phone all of a sudden became colorful. Same thing with keyboards, you know, the old black and white, now you get your laptops in color. These are all sort of more preferences, but I think if there are friendlier technologies and gender friendlier technologies, that helps as well. Can you think of anything, Betty?
Well, I'm thinking of assistive technologies for people with disabilities,
right,
so that they're able to get the same information from the computer as someone who can see or who can type. And
right,
and some of those are very clever things,
right,
that the person can use that plug right into the system.
Braille readers and such,
mm-hmm,
yeah. Because technology has become, again, very visual a lot.
And so
it becomes increasingly difficult, items such as navigating through virtual desktop spaces and such for blind people, for example, or other mobility impaired folks.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an important consideration, that is a demographic that we need,
mm-hmm,
to consider in almost anything we develop. It's mandatory in the government, but it's not mandatory in the commercial world yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be an important, increasingly important product development goal, actually, in the commercial,
mm-hmm,
world,
mm-hmm,
to make it truly accessible and usable in that sense.
Right, mm-hmm, and that's part of the diversity of the population, too, and
right,
diversity of the membership of the society. I've seen a couple of people in wheelchairs.
Right.
You wouldn't see that before.
That's true.
You said something you were at, there were a tremendous number of seeing eye dogs.
Yes, there's a CSUN conference for disabled people once a year in California, and there was an exhibition. And the exhibitor had brought a little duck that squeaked when you pressed it. And they had put these little ducks out in a basket. And unfortunately, the squeak sort of irritated the seeing eye dogs. It just created a little chaos. And
mm-hmm,
the people that were guided by the seeing eye dogs, it was a little confusing and trying to figure out what is going on for those, I'm sure. And I was thoroughly impressed and just flabbergasted how these people manage to negotiate their way through,
mm-hmm,
like the Los Angeles airport, and when they've never been there, all by themselves. And
mm-hmm,
so it's truly a wonderful thing, and it's something where we can really make a difference too,
yes,
if we pay,
mm-hmm,
attention to it.
So. Yes, and accessibility has become a big topic at these conferences.
In fact, the one principle that I did get very excited about in my career, when I heard somebody from the University of Wisconsin describe as a goal principle that if you can make technology work for disabled people, it'll work for all of us.
Yes.
And hence the
mm-hmm
term universal design was sort
right
of born out of that.
Yes.
And was
yeah
with the goal,
mm-hmm,
let's make it work for the people who might need it most, and it'll work for everybody. ATM machines were developed that
mm-hmm
way.
Yeah, it's also called universal usability.
Right.
The idea that if it works for the person with a disability, it'll work for everyone and improve everyone's life.
Well, thank you, Betty, for spending this
time.
Thank
you. It was great. I enjoyed it.